supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Handle of the Spurs, 77-71. They're in Minnesota tonight. The tip at 8. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show for you this week, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we're going to talk about utilizing paper and cardboard. Should they go in the compost pile? Should they be used to block weeds? We'll tell you what we think. We're also going to talk to Michael Petrie, who helped design part of the central exhibit for this year's fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show. He'll give us a little preview. But of course, we got to take your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Roz, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you, Roz. How are you?
I am good. I am thrilled to be talking with you.
Well, I'm thrilled to talk to you. And where is Roz thrilled?
I'm in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, in Bucks County.
Very good. Just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for Roz?
Where I am here, it's about 5 acres and incredibly clayey, and the rain or snow melt water sits on top of the soil. It does not percolate in, and it gets really slippery. So for weeks and weeks and weeks after a rain, we will have mud season here.
Yeah, that's right. That's why they make pots out of this stuff, Roz.
Yes, that's kind of what I want to know about. Is I don't want a pot. I want organic soil.
And what do you want to grow in your organic soil, Roz?
Well, I want to grow everything, but I have a general question, which is wood chips. They're not good as mulch, I understand, because of fungus and other things. Not good for the plants. But if I could use wood chips on my paths, or on my open areas where it's incredibly slippery. There's no lawn to speak of. It's all scrub, and it's just a lot of clay, open clay. Could I use wood chips like that, like liberally spread them around and hope that they're going to be the organic amendment, and eventually they will set up some kind of good soil for me?
The answer to your first question is yes. Wood chips are best used to make walking paths. Now, typically when people spread wood chips in a correct use to make a walking path, they're keeping the weeds down. What I try to get across to people is if you use any kind of wood waste near your home, wood chips, shredded bark, it will breed nuisance molds that will either embarrass you or stain your house permanently or both. No mulch should ever touch a plant, whether it's wood mulch or anything else. No mulch should ever touch a plant. You never see it in nature. And no mulch should ever be deeper than 2 inches, or it actually prevents water from getting to the surface and watering your plants. People have put it in like 6-inch layers of wood mulch around their plants so that they would retain soil moisture, and the plants died of drought because the rain couldn't get through to them. It was just shed by the mulch the whole time. Now, if you're saying you want to take an acre at a time and you want to cover it in like 3 inches of wood chips and wait 3 or 4 years until those wood chips degrade and compost and become rich soil, that's an acceptable plan.
Oh, good.
Because there's no house right near there to be stained. You're not going to be smothering plants with it. The only plants you'd be smothering would be weeds, which, again, is an acceptable use. So, yes, if you want to get a big load delivered and use it to kind of put some nutrition back into your soil, you can do that. And I will tell you that if you want to try to recover some of this land slowly in the fall, beginning in the middle of August, were you to till up some of this clay soil, put grass seed in the fall, it would come up really nicely, and then every couple of falls you could aerate it to get beyond the effects of the clay.
And that would provide a better growing medium eventually?
Yeah, the thing about clay is you can rot all the wood on top of it you want, and then you're just going to have a nice layer of compost on top of that indestructible clay. Clay is like plutonium. The only real way to help plants grow in it is to break it up, is to punch holes in it. But, you know, right now it's like sowing seed on concrete.
Exactly right. I think I've got it. I think it's just going to be a whole lot of work.
Oh, yeah, well, but I mean, it'll be a beautiful reward, too.
Thank you very much.
All right, good luck.
Farewell.
1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you?
I'm good, Mike. How are you?
Okay.
And where is this other Mike okay?
I am calling from Phoenixville, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. Just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for Mike in Phoenixville?
My house faces north-south. I am the west half of a twin. I have a wide-open backyard, so the northwest wind rakes down the side of my house and whips the heat off of it, gets channeled between through the breezeway between me and the next house west. So I want to put an evergreen on the northwest corner of my house to break up the wind as a windbreak.
Mm-hmm.
I made one phone call in reference to this to the Morris Arboretum, spoke to a fellow there who told me that conifers are no good close to a foundation wall because they have invasive roots. He suggested
really?
A holly.
Really?
He said hollies are good. The term he used is foundation trees, that they do not have invasive roots.
Well, I kind of disagree here. The Morris Arboretum is a well-known local arboretum. It's the Arboretum of the University of Pennsylvania. I wonder if maybe he didn't get a little bollocksed up and was trying to warn you against planting a tree that will grow in size too close to the house. The biggest rookie mistake people make when they landscape their own homes, and sometimes even professionals, is they will position a tree next to a house in relation to the size the tree is at that point, which, you know, with the kind of evergreen you're talking about, would be at like a 6 foot high tree. But most of these evergreens, if they're planted correctly, you know, with all the wrappings removed and planted high in the ground in a wide hole that's not deep, are going to thrive. Most evergreens are pretty slow growing. But even so, many of them can achieve really dramatic heights, certainly a minimum of 30, 40 feet when they're full size. And sometimes people do think of the height, but they don't realize these trees get real fat. And a lot of times you see these trees that are either pushing up against the side of the house and creating all sorts of moisture problems, or that have been pruned to the point where they just look terrible because nobody planned for their final size. But to the best of my knowledge, the trees with invasive roots that everybody warns everyone against would be willows and maples and poplars, especially. Poplars are real well known for rearranging sidewalks.
What I would like, one of my sisters has a holly on the back corner of her house. It's about 25 to 30 feet high, and the limbs come right down to the ground with a diameter at the base of the branches of about 10 to 12 feet. I would like something 20 to 30 feet high, conical growth pattern, with a diameter of the base of 8 or 10 feet.
But this holly, she either spent a fortune on or it's been in the ground for 20 years.
Oh, I would say it's got to be 50 to 70 years old. It
yeah,
was there
exactly.
When we bought the house.
Yeah, they're slow-growing plants. And most hollies, in my experience, do not have the form to be a very effective windbreak.
Okay.
I think you'd be looking at three potential plants here. One is an arborvitae, which is the classic conical screening evergreen tree on the East Coast. Most people prefer Leyland cypress, most professionals. It's an underutilized tree, has the same form as an arborvitae, grows remarkably fast, and is probably the healthiest long-lived problem-free tree for one that establishes so quickly and gets growing so quickly. But for my money, you can't do better in a situation like yours than dramatic tall ornamental grasses.
I'm looking for something that will be 20 to 30 feet tall. I have a three-story twin, so right. I'm looking for something that's going to provide some windbreak for the second floor as well.
Right. Then I would think we're talking arborvitae or Leyland cypress, and what you want to do is establish a relationship with a local nursery. As soon as they open up in the spring, let them know what you're looking for. Go to a couple of different nurseries. You have two choices. You can either be patient or you can invest in large specimens that you may need help in planting. The best part about these trees compared to a typical evergreen is they do not have the dramatic lateral growth that a Christmas tree type evergreen would have. So you can tend to plant them in more confined spaces than you can in a tree that's going to cause problems when its skirt starts to spread out.
Yeah, my yard isn't that big. It's either just going to be one big one or three in a row.
Well, then don't plant them in a straight line is what I'm suggesting. Give them a little bit of symmetrical difference, and you'll be much happier with the result. But I think you'll be very pleased with either arborvitae or Leyland cypress. They are the classic plants for this situation. And I'm afraid any other evergreen is just going to have too much lateral growth down low as it gets older.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind the seed starters among us that the magic number is 2 months. That's the ideal time from when your seeds go into the soil, or more correctly, soil-free mix, to when the hardened-off plants get plopped into that unforgiving ground outdoors. And the cool weather lovers like spinach, lettuce, and pansies typically make that trek a solid month or two before heat lovers like peppers and tomatoes. But don't go looking for your seed starting supplies just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls, a preview of this year's Philadelphia Flower Show, and how to use cardboard and paper correctly in your garden and compost. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
This is WHYY.
I'm Mike and Scott. Thanks to the 6,700 listeners who have pledged their support during the WHYY-FM winter membership campaign, we continue to make progress towards the overall goal and need to finish the campaign successfully. We'll return to the air on Monday, February 14th, if we don't meet the goal before the end of this weekend. Now is the time to show your love for WHYY by making a pledge at WHYY.org. With your help, we'll meet the goal before Valentine's Day. Thank you.
So the update is we need $121,000 to reach the goal. And again, we'd like to do it by the end of this weekend. If you would, make your pledge at WHYY.org. Show your support for programs such as You Bet Your Garden. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, PNC Arts Alive, a five-year, $5 million program of the PNC Foundation, supporting innovative arts programming with the goal of making the arts accessible to all. More at PNCArtsAlive.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, do you think it's okay to compost paper in your compost pile? We'll talk about that. What about weeds? Can they be kept down with cardboard and newsprint, or are the chemicals in those things too intense for an organic garden? We'll delve into that issue as well. We'll also take many more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Michael Petrie from Handmade Gardens in Downingtown, Pennsylvania. He's here to talk to us about this year's fabulous Philadelphia International Flower Show. And he's here to tell us a little bit about the flower show, what it involves, and he's going to talk about his exhibit, which is a tribute to the French Impressionists. Ooh, very fancy, Michael.
It's a tribute to Monet, really. The theme that I was sort of assigned by PHS was the artist's garden. So I picked one of my favorite artists, Monet, and we're doing an interpretation of some of his late water lily paintings. And the real challenge with the flower show is how do you do an artist's garden or interpret artists, painters in Paris and France in a garden. So what we're doing is we're laying the paintings flat in the garden as if they were a water feature or a lawn area in a boxwood parterre. And they'll be lit, and the plantings around them won't be lit. And they're going to be, the water lily paintings that Monet did are very abstract. So they're just color fields of reflections of clouds and water on his water lily pond.
We should explain that this year's Philadelphia Flower Show theme is springtime in Paris, so Monet is not at all out of place. The Flower Show, by the way, will run from March 6th to the 13th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. And Michael, the Philadelphia Flower Show is far from a Philadelphia only extravaganza. It's my understanding that the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, who puts on the show, brings in close to a third of the visitors from outside our area, so it truly is an international flower show.
Not only do they pull from the region, but most half of the eastern United States, and then you have a tremendous amount of vendors also in the retail areas from all over the country. So it is a very much a national and now international show.
Last year, visitors to the Flower Show will remember your amazing bamboo garden where you had all this running bamboo and you created these
lanes. It wasn't running.
No.
It wasn't going anywhere.
That's right, because he had killed it first, ladies and gentlemen. He had cut its roots off, or else it would be growing all throughout the convention center now. Don't plant running bamboo, people. And you gave them flashlights on the way in so they could go into the darkness of this bamboo grove and really highlight, as you and I know, you know, it's a pestiferous plant, but the beauty of the culms and the structure of bamboo is heartbreakingly beautiful.
You need to go in and experience a large bamboo grove, and that's part of what we were trying to create. It's a very dark, quiet, meditative place. And handing people a flashlight was trying to get the exhibit to be interactive for the people so that they didn't just look, so that they could find different things in the exhibit. And I always try to get people to be interactive in some sort of movement in the exhibit.
I thought it was a tremendous reminder that whereby with some other flower shows, some smaller ones, and this is not to negate the trouble they go to, but you walk in and you look at things. And Philadelphia is a unique experience. It really is interactive. It almost achieves a fourth dimension somehow.
Yeah, you want to be surrounded by the exhibit when you stand in or near it, or if you walk through it. So it's a challenge. Walk-through exhibits are difficult in a lot of ways because you have to have every spot be perfect. This year's exhibit, we originally were going to do a walk-through, but we sort of changed our mind.
They'd be walking on the paintings.
They'd be walking, exactly, because we're going to have canvas on the what would be the pathways in the garden will be painted canvas this year, as well as the paintings that are set in the parterres.
Is this different for you? Now, how many years ago did you do your first major exhibit for the Philadelphia Flower Show?
When I first got a job in horticulture, I was working not in the business, and I got a job in horticulture at a nursery watering plants, and they knew that I had a art background, and they said, hey, why don't you help us with this thing called the Flower Show? And I did the design for them, and unbeknownst, having never been to the show, had no clue, it was about 30 years ago.
And during that time, you as a designer have won many best of shows.
Many best of shows and awards in all different categories at the Flower Show. Flower arranging, too.
Yeah. And so this is your first time, I believe, however, in the Central Exhibit. For those listeners who have not been able to get to the show or who have it on their to-do list, there is a centrally themed Central Exhibit that's not in the judging categories, but, you know, is generally built by people who've been winning too many best of shows in their categories, and they want to let somebody else get the silver for a change. And then surrounding that is how many dozens of major exhibits under different categories. I know when I was in the editor of Organic Gardening, we were educational non-academic, and then, of course, there was the educational and all the university exhibits.
There's about six judging categories now, and it's broken down by the different types of exhibitors, from the professional trades to the institutional exhibits and the educational, and by invitation. And it's pretty complex, the amount of judging categories they have. For me, the challenge with doing a design for the flower show is to come up with something that is not the same, come up with something that people will – is new and different for people who come to the show every year.
Now, this is a play on something you did several years ago that I remember. I told you at that time that I was jealous of it. You had a giant picture frame.
Picture this.
Suspended in your exhibit, mm-hmm. and the image in the frame changed as you walked mm-hmm. around it.
And that's it's a very simple theatrical technique. You know, if you've ever been to the theater, in a big theater production, they use scrim. Scrim is a material that can be lit from the front or the back. And when you change the light front or back of it, the image that's painted on the scrim, which is essentially like a screen door, will disappear or appear. And it's a very magical technique, especially in a garden like Monet theme, where you have very airy areas of color in the painting. And then we're going to be able to run the scrim up the back side of one of the paintings, so that the scrim will light up and the painting will seem to, hopefully, it will seem to float in space, and there'll be a sense of movement because the light will go off and on the painting, and that gives you change of, you know, it's like change of sunlight in a garden, which was always an important concept for the Impressionists, was how the light changed during the day.
So whereby in another flower show in another city, we'd make sure the flowers were accurate to a French Impressionist garden. We'd probably have a statue of a guy, or maybe try to clone Monet.
This isn't that, right. This is not, the recreation of Monet's garden. This is a creation of my impression of his garden, and I've never been there.
So it's an impressionist doing an impressionist. This
right.
is like three guys walk
like
into a bar.
It's a joke, yeah. right. This is a big...
But I know your attention to detail. I know your need to dramatize and really raise the stakes in all the exhibits you've done over the years. And this sounds like a real potential tour de force. And if it's not on Friday night, I know you'll tear it down and rebuild it again before the judges see it on Saturday morning, right?
That's right. You're never over until it's done, so...
Well, it's great to have you in the central exhibit. I'm sure the people in your category are thrilled to have you out of it for a year, so somebody else can finally win Best of Show for a change. Thank you very much, Michael Petrie. Anything else you want to tell us about this year's show or this year's exhibit? I mean, I wish we could really... I mean, we've done a little bit in explaining to people the levels, the notes that are hit. Mm-hmm. at the Philadelphia Flower Show compared to something they may have seen outside of Philadelphia. But how do you really get that magic across? There's, I've been to all these other shows, and it's some of them are really good, but there is nothing like Philadelphia. The excitement of the people as they're coming in, they can't wait to see what's happened.
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you have to realize that this is an entertainment venue. And that the show is entertainment. More and more every year, the show becomes more entertaining for the people. So it's more exciting. There's activities on the show floor now. There's dance and music and sound. And it's not only just static plants and gardens that just sit there quietly. Now it's something that happens.
Michael Petrie is the head of Handmade Gardens, a nursery in Downingtown, Pennsylvania. He's been associated with the Flower Show for many, many years. If I ran off the titles of his exhibits and what was in them, you would recall them from previous Flower Show years. If you've never been to the Flower Show before, make plans to do it this year or soon. There is really no other celebration of horticulture like this anywhere else in the world. And again, it takes place March 6th to the 13th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center, which, despite its name, is in Philadelphia. Michael Petrie from Handmade Gardens, thanks so much for coming in today to talk to us about the Flower Show.
Thanks, Mike.
1-888-346-9499. Candy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, Candy. How are you?
fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Where is Candy?
Ventura, California.
Boy, I could use a little bit of Southern California right now, Candy.
Oh, bad weather, huh?
Oh, it's been a terrible winter. And I'm just so jealous. I can't even tell you. What can we do for Candy?
About 15 years ago when we bought our house, I thought morning glories would look really nice. You know, white ones, they would match the white trim on our house. They have taken over. And my husband, he is constantly having to go in and rip them out. And then I swear, 3 days later, they're back.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you deliberately planted white morning glory, did you?
Well, it said on the package, but they ended up purple.
Oh, okay, said, good. And the morning glories that are troubling you now are purple.
Yeah, we don't have any white ones.
There is a cultivated morning glory said to have a white flower, but it's very rare. When people call me up and say, I had morning glory show up on my property and they're taking over, I say, what color is the flower? And if they say white, then I have to tell them they have one of the most tenacious agricultural weeds that there is. It looks exactly like a morning glory. It has a white flower, but it's actually a plant called bindweed. It is a pest of northeastern and midwestern gardens. Now, a lot of people are scratching their heads in the Northeast right now listening to you. Because you are in Southern California, you don't have the killing frost to get rid of them. What for us is an annual flower is for you a perennial. The warmer the climate, the more true morning glories can become a really pesky weed, as you found out. With any weed, and that's what your flowers have become, unfortunately, the answer to getting control of them is always, where are they? So is this growing in a lawn, in a flower bed, a vegetable garden, up the side of your house?
They grow up out of the lawn, but they're all through the avocado trees. They're growing up on the side of the house. They're growing where my husband grows the vegetables.
If we were to prevent them from flowering for a full season, you would break the cycle. I will tell you, it is excruciatingly important not to let any flower, because they form their seed heads very quickly after they flower. You have a southern lawn. Do you know what you have?
I think it's kikuyu or something.
Yeah, some Southern California grass. If you keep your grass cut at an inch and a half or 2 inches, the morning glory should not get established very much. In your flower beds, this would be a good time to pick areas. Really soak the soil. Get down low, or hire some kids to come in and get down low and pull slowly at the base of the plant and try to get out as much of the root as you can. And then when you clean an area, lay down a thick mulch over top.
Okay.
So that as you clean an area, you prevent any underground root mass from getting through easily. You will still have some trying to get through. But if you have even an inch or two of mulch out there, what gets through will be short and spindly and very easy to pull. So at the end of a season, in a flower bed or a vegetable garden, you can get control of them. Now, with the lawn, I would be ready to put down some corn gluten meal. Corn gluten meal is a springtime natural pre-emergent weed and feed. That'll prevent any new seeds that were dropped the previous year from flowers from sprouting. And then if you keep the lawn mowed, you should prevent photosynthesis. You're fighting drop seed, but you also have an underground root mass that's going to keep trying to re-sprout. But if that root mass can't feed itself by leaves collecting sunlight, it will die as well. I would get a flame weeder. The smallest ones are handheld devices. You screw a propane tank into one end, and you got a long wand that comes out the other end, and you push a little clicker on the arm, and a flame comes out. And all you have to do is stand back, and when you see a morning glory, just wave the flaming wand like 6 inches away from the plant, and you'll see it'll all wilt. And you'll kill that plant, and you'll actually shock the root mass underground. It's very stressful to the plant, but the great reason to have the flame weeder around is if you see a flower anywhere, just go torch that flower right away, and you'll make sure that it won't be dropping any seed.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I wrote everything down you said. So.
Good. That's the only disadvantage of living in a climate like yours, is you don't have killing frost to control these plants.
I know. It's like spring now. Everything's blooming.
Yeah,
I mean,
rub it in, Candy. All right, all right. That's
it. It's beautiful here.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and throw some cold water on potential seed starters who think they can use garden soil in, quote, a sunny south-facing window to grow plants that look as good as the ones in the garden center. They will not. Garden soil is the worst seed starting medium you can imagine. And, quote, sunny south-facing window is actually Latin for, hey, your plants are dead. Use soil-free mix and artificial light or buy your plants pre-started. Please! But don't you go reading our extremely helpful questions of the week on seed starting just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fascinating phone calls and how to use compost and paper correctly in the garden. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
This is WHYY, 38 degrees in Center City, winds at 20 miles an hour.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. I'll appear at the Capitol Home and Garden Show at the Dulles Expo Center in Chantilly, Virginia on Friday, February 25th, then race back to our friendly confines to appear on Saturday and Sunday, the 26th and 27th, at the Suburban Home and Garden Show at the Expo Center in Oaks, PA. The Philadelphia International Flower Show opens on Sunday, March 6th, and runs through Sunday, March 13th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in Center City, Philly. This year's theme is Springtime in Paris, and I'll deliver my annual flower show lecture at 12:30 on Wednesday, March 9th. All of the lectures and workshops are free with flower show admission. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
We'd like to give you an update on our winter membership campaign goal here at WHYY. First, thanks to all the listeners who've pledged their support. We're making progress toward our goal, but we need $121,000 to finish successfully. And with your help, we'll reach that goal by the end of this weekend. So we invite you to jump in and join the family here at WHYY. Support terrific programming such as You Bet Your Garden. Make a pledge online right now at WHYY.org. And thank you.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to a fascinating question of the week. Should paper be composted? Should it be a part of your compost pile? Is it safe to use newspaper and or cardboard in the garden as weed block? We will address these topics directly after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Deepak, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Always good to hear from our friends down there. One of our favorite towns, one of the first cities to pick us up.
Very cool. My question is about tulsi or holy basil. We'd like to grow it. We have some seeds that a friend of ours gave us, and I wanted to know, when is the best time to sow the seeds and how best to grow it, either in a pot or outside, and it survive the next winter?
Oh, man, that's going to be tough. See, you don't have a very long gardening season to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And you have lousy soil in Oklahoma.
Okay.
So it's a difficult place to garden. A basil likes a very warm climate. Most basil is an annual. That is, it's a plant that's going to grow for a season, and then whether the frost comes through or not, eventually it'll peter out and die. It was not meant to go on forever. It survives from generation to generation by setting seed. Now, that said, your holy basil, which is a sacred variety in India, as I probably don't have to tell you, I would imagine you're growing it to harvest the plant for an Ayurvedic medicine?
Yeah, we usually take some leaves and put it in our tea or milk and drink it so that we get the benefits of it.
To grow this plant outdoors and have it live from season to season would require you be in zone 10 to 12. I don't think there are any zones in the United States that are that warm. So it's a very tropical plant. Most of the time in this country, it is grown as an annual. And you can do that. What you need to do is you need to start the seeds indoors. You're going to have to go buy dedicated seed starting mix, a very light, loose mix. Get some specialized containers or some old garden six packs. Fill them with the seed starting mix. Put two or three seeds into each cell. Make sure the mix is really moist. You probably want to moisten it before you put the seeds in.
Okay.
Get it really wet. Put the seeds in. Cover the seeds with a little bit more. Then stretch plastic wrap over the top. And just let it sit out in a warm spot in your house. Look at it every day. When you see the first sprouts up, take the plastic off, throw the plastic away, and then put those starts under bright light. Four-foot-long fluorescent tubes, just a single shop light. Keep the top of the plants almost touching the tubes.
Okay.
Water it when they get dry, and then feed it occasionally a couple of times. And then when they're about 6 weeks old, then you can transplant them out to the garden where they'll need a nice rich soil enriched with compost. Where you are in Oklahoma, you want to make sure that they have adequate water. You don't want to rot them, but you also want to make sure they don't dry out. They might like a little protection from your wind, too. They might like to be planted in a place where they get full sun, but they got a little bit of a wind break. And then you should get a lot of basil to harvest over the summer. And so if you go online, go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org. Right up at the top of the page is a link that says Garden Answers A to Z. Just click on S, the letter S, go to Seed Starting, and it'll give you all the details about starting seeds indoors, the timing, the light, the food, the kind of soil mix. Once you have them, and they're nice and strong inside, and they're 6 weeks old, then they're exactly like tomato plants or any other plant in the summertime garden. The good news is that if you respect the needs of the plant and that it needs to be warm and that you need to have good, sturdy, solid 6 weeks old starts to put outside, then it's no harder to grow than any other plant in the summer.
All right, so you've answered all my questions.
All right, good luck. Let us know how this works out, because it is a fabulous plant, and as you know, the cultural history goes back millennia.
It is, you're right. Well, thank you.
Have a good day. 1-888-346-9499. Louise, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thank you for making it, Louise. Where are you?
Well, I'm in Wayne, Pennsylvania, in the western Philadelphia suburbs.
I know where Wayne, PA is. All right, what can we do for Louise?
Well, I have avidly listened to your show about how to do container gardening right, and my spirit is willing, but my flesh is weak because I have a second floor deck, and I'm almost 70, and I know I have about, I have like 14 pots out there that I've been growing mostly tomatoes in, and they're large pots.
Okay.
And I realize that I should change the soil every year or rotate crops or all of the above. And I am doing this organically.
Good.
But is there any way that I can cut corners on changing out all the soil? I heard a tip somewhere that you could fill the base of these things with rigid foam plastic that you know, electronics come in, but that doesn't sound like a good idea.
So you started with good bags of soil-free mix when you filled your containers originally?
Yes, and they've been in there for some time.
Okay.
And I put organic fertilizer in there.
Okay, but you've not replenished any of the soil-free mix or added any kind of compost or anything?
Not in a while.
Well, a combination of potting soil, soil-free mix, professional mix, and compost is the ideal for container gardeners.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sensing that the topic here is mostly avoiding having stuff dragged out to the second floor. You're willing to work with what you have out on the deck. You don't have any problem turning the pots over and moving soil around, do you?
No, I have frequently moved soil from one pot to the other while I was planting, you know, because I would take some out, put the plant in, and then put it back, and so forth.
Okay. Now, obviously the issue here is you can't grow tomatoes after tomatoes in the same soil forever, or you're going to start developing soil-borne wilts, where the plants start to turn yellow at the bottom, and then the yellowness moves up. Has that affected your tomatoes yet?
Yes, some varieties. I've had some that survived just fine. They must have been very, very disease resistant. And others that died off mid-season.
I can tell you that sooner or later, after you've grown tomatoes in the same garden spot or the same container over and over again, doesn't matter how resistant they are, the wilts will have their way. So the key issue here is either marking or keeping a notebook of where you grew tomatoes, and then you grow something else in those pots the following year. But for instance, if you've had vines coming out of a pot year after year, that's a prime pot for growing tomatoes now.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take one of the tomato pots and use that to grow your vines. It's always good when these pots have been out there for a year to get a tub and get a little shovel or a little trowel and get some of the potting mix out of there. And then just go in and essentially till it up, loosen up the soil in the pots because it has become compressed. And what I would do is if you can get somebody to take a bag of anything up to that balcony for you, I would get a bag of the highest quality compost I could, and I would mix some of the compost in with all of your pots. It's going to make your organic fertilizer much more effective, for instance.
Okay. I can move these pots around myself. I put them all on wheels.
Oh, good, good, good. That's what my wife threatens to do to me. And then the other thing you were talking about, which is putting styrofoam or some other foreign material in the bottom of the pots, that's the worst idea. People used to recommend that all the time, and it is totally wrong. When you're growing in a container, plants want soil to go as far down as the bottom of the container. They don't want to lose any space to any kind of peanuts or styrofoam or broken pots. And even though it seems like it should, it does not improve the drainage at all.
It was just the weight issue that somebody suggested it.
If you are using really good soil-free mix, and you don't even have a lot of compost in there to begin with, most of the weight is water.
Mm-hmm.
So when your pots are dried out, you know, for instance, maybe throw some tarps over them at the end of the winter, during rainstorms, let them dry out naturally. They'll be much easier to handle at planting time and manhandle and move around when the mix is dry. And then you just wet it again and you'll restore the weight to the pots.
Oh, that's a really good idea.
All right, Louise, good luck next year. Okay,
thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Using paper wisely in the compost and in the garden. We begin with an email from Anne in Doylestown, PA, who writes, I'm a devoted fan of your show looking for composting advice. Many gardening websites recommend adding shredded paper to the compost pile. I'm concerned that the inks on printed paper may contain chemicals, and I won't have a truly organic compost come next spring. So should I add paper, not add paper? Help! Well, Anne, unfortunately, many people who give composting advice have either never actually done it, are not thinking their recommendations through, or both. I, however, have composted for 25 years, tend to think these things through maybe a little bit too much, and don't like the idea of composting paper for many reasons. One, paper is one of the most easily recycled materials in today's enlightened world. Virtually everyone has an easy way to get old newspapers, magazines, and mixed paper into a waste stream where it gets turned into more paper, or tissues, or toilet paper, or some other essential element of modern society, thus reducing our society's need for virgin paper, which we otherwise refer to as trees. Two, while some modern inks, like the soy-based ones popular in newspaper printing, are fairly innocuous, inks that are made for some other purposes still use petroleum and metals in their manufacture. In addition, some of the paper itself has been bleached with chlorine, a particularly nasty player whose breakdown produces dangerous dioxins. Three, and most importantly, there is little to no nutrition left in processed paper, and it won't add much, if any, fertilizing or disease-preventing power to your finished product of compost. That's why I'm always yelling at all of you to collect and shred massive amounts of fall leaves. Shredded leaves make the finest disease-preventing, soil-enhancing, plant-feeding compost. If you have a compost pile where the predominant brown materials are paper, however, instead of leaves, you're creating the equivalent of a heavily processed artificial fast food for your plants. Compost made with shredded leaves is minimally processed, high-quality, slow food. Hey, and it's local, too. We move on to Catherine in Noakesville, Virginia, who writes, "Mike, I read that burying wet newspapers around plants will prevent weeds from coming up. Should I try this? Could I use old magazines as well? And exactly how do you do this?" Sandy in Kutztown, PA, has a similar question. "My son purchased a home last year that has an unused vegetable garden he and I want to bring back into production. I've gardened organically since the 70s and have never used any paper or cardboard because I believe that both contain chemicals I don't want in my food. So I told him that his idea of mulching with cardboard is a no-go. But how about brown craft paper? He wants to use that in the walkways that we will create between our long rows of raised beds to keep down the weeds. I worry that as the paper breaks down, it'll leach chemicals into the soil, which will be taken up by roots that grow near or under the pathways. What do you think?" Well, the last time I tackled this question in print, which was way back in 2004, I, like you, worried about the possibility of glues and chemicals and such in cardboard. Afterwards, however, I received a very thoughtful note from somebody in the industry who gently explained that there is no single thing known as, quote, cardboard. That's a catch-all term used to cover a wide array of heavy-duty paper-based products. He added that he was in the cardboard box business and was pleasantly surprised to learn that corrugated cardboard shipping boxes are very clean. Just about all paper, no glues, and no bleach. As a result, I've become more enthusiastic over the years about the idea of using cardboard and black and white newsprint as a weed block under soil or mulch. Now, sorry to our first questioner there, not just, quote, around plants. It has to be used correctly. Now, you may have even heard me suggest on a recent show that a caller planning to build raised beds level the soil, mark out the areas for the beds no more than 4 feet wide, but as long as you want. Lay down single pieces of cardboard or entire sections of newspapers over the bare ground, and then build and fill the raised bed frames over top of that weed block. Same with the walking lanes, which should be 2 feet wide, by the way. Lay down newspaper or cardboard, and then cover this rustic weed barrier with the mulch of your choice. This is one of the only good uses for shredded bark or wood chips. Now, is this plan 100% free of potential chemicals? Of course it isn't. Neither is rainwater, animal manure, or scraps from conventionally grown produce. You pays your money and you takes your choices. I, for instance, will mix some horse manure into my compost piles when it's available, well knowing that the horse may have been medicated. To me, it's still a great use of a nutrient-rich ingredient, and I accept the small amount of risk. Whereas I see no benefit and way too much risk in making compost from paper. Too many problems, too little nutrition, too many other and better ways to reuse that paper. And, as just noted, I've gradually come to the conclusion that it's perfectly acceptable to use cardboard and newsprint, but not slick magazines or mixed paper, as a weed block. Now, you may come to a different conclusion. That's just fine. It's your garden. Well, that sure was some interesting information and opinion about pulped paperish products, wasn't it? Luckily, you can stroll through the print version of the Question of the Week at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to lay me down to block the weeds if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Just be sure to tell us where you live and put the actual subject, that's nouns and verbs, kiddos, into the subject line. Or check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solutions to hundreds of garden problems. Hint, hint, like the one you were going to ask me. Hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz is our webmaster. His assistant, Sarah Kazar, rules the savage land. Our intern, Jessica Mandick, never puts paper in the compost. Neither does Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our esteemed editor, Al Banks, is such a good composter. He brings in his spent coffee grounds every week so that I can incorporate them into my piles. I'm king of the compost, Mike McGrath. You know, I was kind of hoping for king of the castle, but my wife just looked at me when I said that and said, compost. So I'll see you next week. Container gardeners often wonder what to do with their old potting soil. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to get the most life out of your old soil-free mix. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Azaleas, amaryllis, sarsaparillas, we inch towards spring. Mike helps us to ameliorate that wintry brown patch out back with advice every Saturday morning at 11 here on WHYY.